This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Zinta A-Stars talks with author and historian Larry Massey. His latest book tells the story of Borges Hospital, which is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. But first, when the U.S. Supreme Court issued its ruling in June that made same-sex marriage legal, it meant that gay couples could marry across the country. It also meant that part of Michigan's constitution is now obsolete. And the Citizens Research Council of Michigan says there are several sections of the state constitution which have been made inoperative over the years. They have issued a report calling for those parts to be removed. The report is called A Reminder to Clean Up the Michigan Constitution. Craig Thiel is Senior Research Associate for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. Craig Thiel, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's explain to our audience, is it mostly court decisions which make some part of the Michigan Constitution obsolete or invalid over time?
That is one mechanism. It's probably the largest source of invalid provisions in the Constitution. But we've also had changes to the federal Constitution that have made obsolete provisions in our state Constitution. An example there is we have a provision that says you have to be 21 years of age to vote. And we know that the federal Constitution makes the requirement 18 years. And of course, the federal Constitution trumps state Constitution. So that provision is obsolete by virtue of a change to the federal Constitution.
So same-sex marriage, voting age, what are some other examples in the Michigan Constitution where there have been changes either at the court level or in the federal Constitution which have made some section of Michigan's Constitution now invalid?
Yeah, so some of them are pretty general and people would be familiar with them, and others are pretty deep down in the weeds. One example of something that people might be familiar with is term limitations on federal representatives. We passed in 1992 a provision that attempted to limit the number of terms that our federal delegation, federal representatives, could serve in Congress. And in 1995, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states could not limit federal officials. That was the province solely of the federal constitution. So that provision is obsolete.
And just to clarify here, the provision in there which allows for term limits on the governor and the state house and senate, that stood because the state can enforce term limits on those offices.
Exactly. And the federal constitution gives states the authority to limit the terms of office for state officials, governor, attorney general, secretary of state, senator, representative.
What are some other things that are in the Michigan Constitution, which right now are just taking up space for the most part?
Right. We talked about the same-sex marriage ban that was added to our state constitution in 2004 through a citizen-led initiative. Article 1, Section 25 of the Michigan Constitution now is obsolete because of the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court allowing for same-sex marriage. There's a provision in Article 2, Section 6 that limits the ability to vote based on ownership of property. And the U.S. Supreme Court in 1970 ruled that that could not be a condition of exercising the voting right, and ruled that that provision is effectively unconstitutional in our state constitution. And then there's another provision having to do with state aid to non-public schools. So this would be private schools, religious schools. In the 1970s, there was a push to put a constitutional provision in that would prohibit aid to these type of entities. And through the courts, it was ruled that direct aid to non-public schools, private schools, was okay. However, you couldn't prevent a non-public school student or a private school student from enrolling in a public school and getting part of their education through a public school. And that provision still is allowed under our state constitution.
So if it's decided that it's a good idea to find all of these sections of the Michigan Constitution, as you suggest in this report, and remove them in some way, what's the actual process for doing that?
Right. Well, it can go about, one of three ways. All of them will have to involve a constitutional amendment. The legislature can't just go in and say, well, the federal courts have ruled that this provision is obsolete and we have the authority to take a marker to the Constitution and or an eraser and strike them. This will have to come from a vote of the people. And that can originate either with the citizens themselves. They could propose a constitutional or a series of constitutional amendments to do this cleanup. That would involve collecting signatures and then going to the ballot and getting approval that way. It could originate with the legislature, who would propose a series of constitutional amendments, get the requisite votes in each chamber to then put that on the ballot and then get voter approval that way. So that's the second method. And then the third method, we'd have to wait. Again, it would require a vote. But if we were to call a constitutional convention, this would be something that would be addressed in that venue as well.
Now, as you say in this report, most of these provisions can be removed from the Michigan Constitution and just not replaced and would not affect the operations of government. There is an exception, though. You do say that there is one change that the state should make and actually replace it, and that has to do with how legislative districts are drawn. What are you proposing here?
Right. So our report kind of looked at the Constitution through two lenses. One was what provisions are obsolete because of actions by the federal Supreme Court or through the changes to the U.S. Constitution, and those provisions could be just struck from our state constitution. And then there's provisions that we found inoperable but probably need to be replaced in some form. And the one that has come to the forefront and has received some attention through the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in the Arizona redistricting case has to do with our provisions in the Constitution dealing with congressional and legislative redistricting. Those provisions were ruled unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court in the early 1980s. And as a default, the legislature in Michigan has controlled that process exclusively in terms of both setting the standards by which redistricting occurs, as well as the actual drawing up of the district maps every 10 years. And our recommendation, in short, is that we should examine what the Constitution had in place in terms of a redistricting commission, as well as the standards for redistricting. And those should be spelled out in the state Constitution and not solely up to the discretion of the legislature.
I want to note this is not a new idea from the Citizens Research Council. You guys put out a report on this a few years ago, and I believe we might have interviewed Eric Lufer when it was first published. But can you explain why it is that a group like yours, which is a nonpartisan research organization, has taken an interest in this? Because there are certainly some groups right now who are affiliated with the Democratic Party who would like to see some changes because they think the Republicans have been putting their thumb on the scale. Why, from a more of a good government perspective, is it a good idea to have some sort of an independent commission drawing legislative districts?
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's important that we have this process enshrined in the Constitution. So we suggest that at a minimum, however we decide to go about redistricting, it should be locked into the Constitution and not subject to the whims of statutory law, so that if someone doesn't like the outcome, they can just change a law and therefore change the outcome. So, and we looked back in past constitutions and we found that each of the previous constitutions had the process of redistricting spelled out in those documents. And so the people in the past have spoken and said, this is important. We need to lock this into the Constitution. And so when we did our report that you referred to in 2011, we surveyed other states. We looked at kind of best practices in redistricting. And we came to the conclusion that it makes most sense for redistricting to be done by an independent commission, not unlike the one that was proposed in our 1963 Constitution that was subsequently ruled unconstitutional because of other provisions in the section dealing with redistricting. But having that nonpartisan, independent commission would divorce the process from the political process that takes place currently with redistricting.
Going back for a moment to these other provisions of the Constitution, which, as you say, are really at this point inoperative or have pretty much been invalidated by other events such as federal court rulings, if they're not being enforced, what is the danger of leaving language in the state constitution, which at this point has become archaic?
Well, I don't know that there's necessarily any harm in that, but I think if we're going to have a written constitution, it should be up to date. And if people are going to pick up their state constitution from the office of their state legislature or from the library, whether it's at a school or a public library, and they pick up the document to learn about how government in Michigan is set up and is functioning, it should be accurate. So, yes, you're correct. There's no harm in having these obsolete provisions in there. But I think if we're going to have a constitutional democracy, the document should be reflective of the current reality of government. We shouldn't expect citizens to have to then carry along a stack of federal court rulings or the federal constitution to then cross-reference whether or not a provision is obsolete or not.
Does this perhaps illustrate the nature of how a state constitution functions quite differently from the federal constitution, that state constitutions are rewritten much more often, they're amended more often, and therefore, perhaps, maybe they get into some details that the federal constitution doesn't, that the federal constitution is more of a broad overview of government, and that state constitutions maybe reflect, in the case of, you know, citizen-led referendum for amendments, maybe the times, you know, the mood of the moment, and that this is how they end up, perhaps, with some sections in them which you look back on and say, well, boy, at this point, it really doesn't apply to how we're living. Is there just a real fundamental difference between our federal constitution and our state constitutions?
Most definitely. I think Michigan is a good example. We've tended to legislate a little more in our state constitution and kind of there's definitely the building blocks and the foundations of our government are laid out in the constitution, but I think layered on top of them have been some very specific provisions that are generally reserved for, you know, the legislative arena and statutory law. There's provisions, lengthy provisions, on the disposition of fees for hunting and fishing in our state constitution. Most of that type of language would be reserved for, you know, statutory law in most states. And so these are, you know, the results, I think, of some of the ease in which we can put things into our state constitution. As we know, it takes a threshold number of votes, 10% of the vote for governor, to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, and it takes 8% of the vote for governor to put a statutory-led initiative on the ballot. So these are thresholds that maybe 50, 60 years ago were difficult to overcome, and putting those provisions in front of the voters were difficult, but today with paid signature gatherers, it's easier to get access to enshrining, you know, public policy preferences into the state constitution.
Craig Thiel, thank you very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure.
Craig Thiel is Senior Research Associate for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. A link to their report, A Reminder to Clean Up the Michigan Constitution, can be found at crcmich.org. There's also a link at our website, wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. This year, Borges Hospital in Kalamazoo is marking its 125th anniversary. The hospital commissioned historian Larry Massey to write a book about its history, Healthcare Anew, the First 125 Years of Borges Health. Zinta Astars spoke with Larry Massey. A segment of this interview first aired on Between the Lines in May.
Larry, how did this project first come about?
Well, I've been involved with Borges since the early 1980s, writing their histories. My first book, A History of Kalamazoo, that I co-authored with Peter Schmidt. We had a nice spread about Borges and that, and then I helped them with their 110th anniversary and their 100th anniversary and now the 125th anniversary.
So take us back to the beginning. This is 125 years ago, Kalamazoo in 1889. Help us visualize, what is Kalamazoo like in 1889?
Well, Kalamazoo in the 1880s was, the population was around 17,000. And it was a booming industrial mecca. All kinds of entrepreneurs were coming to Kalamazoo to manufacture buggies and windmills and railroad velocipedes, corsets, cigars. In the middle of the 1880s, W.E. Upjohn arrived and began producing his friable pill. It means you could push it down and it would turn into powder.
Mm.
And so lots of things were happening. It became a city in 1884. Before that, it had been a village. And it was also the celery city. A lot of these Dutch immigrants were coming in and buying up the muck land, and Kalamazoo had a reputation around the country as the celery city. So things were going pretty good for Kalamazoo, with one little problem. If you got sick, there was no hospital. I mean, if you were well-to-do, you might get on the Michigan Central train and go down to Battle Creek and check into Dr. John Harvey Kellogg's Battle Creek Sanitarium, where you could try out the healthful aspects of cornflakes or enemas. That's what they kind of specialized in. But for people in Kalamazoo, there was no hospital. There were hospitals in other cities in Kalamazoo, but you wonder why there was no hospital. Basically, the city fathers were tight-fisted. They did not want to spend the money to build a hospital. This is the same kind of people that in the middle of the Great Depression of the 1930s, Kalamazoo was the only city of its size in the nation without indebtedness. So that was mainly it.
So that was their first priority, this remaining out of debt rather than health care?
Yeah, than offering a city service like that. But the man who would change all that arrived in Kalamazoo in 1883, Father Francis O'Brien. He'd been born in Monroe in 1851 and grew up, his parents were Irish immigrants, and he'd grown up to really love the Catholic Church. His mentor and friend, Bishop Caspar Borges, kind of backed him. And in 1883, he sent him to Kalamazoo to take over the parish. When he arrived, he found a mess. The church was crumbling. People had bad morale. And Kalamazoo had become a national scandal because a parish priest in 1881 by the name of Quinn had published a book. It was called A Substitution for Marriage. He was saying that the priests were treating the nuns like wives, and that was a scandal all over the nation. So he set to work and got the parish going better and got some funds to repair the church and other things. And then something happened that, you know, sometimes history is made by just seemingly non-related things, but can later become very, very important. In 1884, the state fair was held in Kalamazoo. In those days, it revolved around the different cities. And, you know, when the fair happens, there's a lot of hilarity and jollity and things like that. And carnies come into town, and it's a different place. Well, there was a lot of taverns in Kalamazoo in those days, and there was a lot of over-imbibing. And so the city police force was real busy escorting people that had over-imbibed to the city lockup. Well, they found a youth who was stumbling along the wooden sidewalks and assumed he was drunk and took him to jail. A couple hours later, the turnkey realized he was not drunk. He was deathly ill. They searched him and found no identification, but they did find a rosary in his pocket. So they summoned Father O'Brien. And there, amidst the curses and the terrible smell and everything of that drunk tank, Father O'Brien administered the last rites to that youth. Later found out that he was the promising son of a very well-to-do family who was just chagrined to find out that their son had died in jail.
I can imagine.
Yeah, and it left a lasting imprint on Father O'Brien. He determined that this should not happen again, that someone sick should die in jail. He told a story to his friend Bishop Borges, and in 1888, Bishop Borges sent Father O'Brien a check for $5,000, which he had inherited, and he said, "Do with this whatever you want, but I was really moved by that story about the youth dying in jail. And if you want to build a hospital with it, you have my blessing. But he said, be aware that it's going to be a hard uphill battle. So Father O'Brien announced the receipt of that check on Christmas Eve in 1888. And the next year, he put it as a down payment on an Italianate mansion on Portage and Lovell. That was going to be Borges Hospital. Well, his next step was to get someone to staff the hospital and do the work. He inquired all over the nation for some Sisters of St. Joseph, who were very skilled nursing sisters, and couldn't find any until finally he located a convent in Watertown, New York, that could spare 11 of the sisters. They arrived in Kalamazoo July 6, 1889, and set about converting that mansion into a hospital. They did everything, scrubbed the walls, painted everything. And December 9, 1889, Borges Hospital, named after Bishop Borges, opened. The next few years were tough financially, but gradually more and more people began coming to Borges, and they built additions. There were about five different additions, and grew. It became a 100-bed hospital by 1917. It was still too small to take care of all the sick people in Kalamazoo. And so they decided that they would build a new Borges out on Gull Road, and they did in 1917. Both hospitals stayed open until 1929, when the old Borges, as it was called, closed. The Upjohn Company bought that property, tore down the old hospital, and built one of their buildings, and that is the site of the new Homer Stryker Medical School. So kind of everything comes back around.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about those 11 sisters and what they must have felt like when they arrived in town. Hadn't somebody warned them that I think there was something about a letter that the Indians were going to carry them away when they arrived?
They encountered an old priest on their way to Kalamazoo, and he said, oh, Kalamazoo, he says, that's terrible. He said, the Indians will carry you off when you get there. So that had him worried. It didn't help that when they got to the Michigan Central Station, nobody was waiting there for them. With their heavy luggage, they had to trudge down the hot streets of Kalamazoo until they found the hospital. The hospital
that was
going to be a hospital.
GPS.
Yeah, right. Sure was.
And then there was, in that history, a devastating flu epidemic that hit not only Kalamazoo, but the country and even beyond that. Tell us a little more about that.
Oh, it was the influenza epidemic of 1917, 1918. It was just a terrible, it's kind of related to swine flu, but it was, it killed people. It killed millions of people, millions of Americans and millions of people across the entire world. They called it the Spanish flu, even though it didn't start in Spain. And the hospital in Kalamazoo was inundated with sick people, especially the students at Western who were studying military. And because they were like in dorms, the flu spread quickly. But they survived. The Borges Hospital survived, and many of the people that were recuperating there also survived.
And people working there who were caring
exactly.
for the patients, yeah.
The nurses were really had a hard time because there were so many sick people that they had beds in the halls.
And Dr. Homer Stryker, you mentioned him a little earlier.
Yeah.
Talk about his role in Borges and some of the state-of-art technology that he brought into being.
Right. Well, he was a veteran of World War One, and then he grew up in Calhoun County. And he got his medical training in the 1930s, advanced medical training, and he settled in Kalamazoo. And one of the sisters in charge at Borges Hospital, knew that he was an inventor, and so they allotted him space in the basement of the hospital to do his inventions, providing that if he did invent something good, he would let them benefit from it as well. And so Dr. Homer Stryker invented this amazing oscillating cast-cutting saw, invented the rubber heel for a walking cast, invented the circle electric bed, which allowed people to be moved around without having to take them out of bed, all kinds of amazing inventions. And it started there in the basement of Borges.
And help us visualize also this early hospital, what it was like. When I was reading your book, I was interested in the description of private rooms versus the wards. And one of the things that occurred to me is it seemed like it was just so possible to have all kinds of infections when some of these private rooms were described as very much like bedrooms at home. I wondered about the sanitary conditions.
Yeah, well, doctors didn't really know as much about that back in those days. And if you see pictures of the private rooms, you know, there's like a buffet with all kinds of knickknacks on it. And there's pictures on the wall and all kinds of things like that. But, you know, they were very, very cheap back then. Father O'Brien came up with a form of insurance for $5 a year for the entire year. If you got sick, you had the use of Borges Hospital. For $10 a year, you had a private room in Borges Hospital if it was needed.
And it seemed like for many years, the idea of providing health care free of cost to those who couldn't pay seemed very important.
Oh, yeah. They accepted what they called charity cases.
Mm-hmm.
And people of any religion, of any ethnic background, were welcome at Borges. You know, there's this idea of the open arms. If you look at what was called the New Borges out on Gull Road, the way it is shaped, the wings, as it's facing Gull Road, it looks like open arms welcoming anybody that needs help. And that was deliberately done.
I didn't realize that was deliberately done that way.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
We think it was.
Now, mention to us the major points of growth in technology. What kind of things have we seen over 125 years?
Well, we've seen the X-ray machine. They didn't have that back in 1889. We've seen all sorts of things like iron lungs, which there was a polio epidemic in which people were paralyzed, couldn't breathe at night. They'd have to put them in an iron lung. We've seen so many new techniques of heart surgery that started at Borges Hospital. It's just a revolutionary. You know, there's a saying, the good old days. Well, the good old days back in the 1880s were terrible. To prove that, all you have to do is to walk into a cemetery and see one after one of the graves of these children and families. The whole family would die from infectious diseases.
Yeah.
So it's been revolutionized.
And then there was a change from general practitioners to specialists. How
right.
and why did that happen?
They made the decision in the 1970s and 1980s to recruit specialists because they felt that was what Kalamazoo needed. And so they looked all over the country and picked out certain people that specialized in heart surgery or different things like that, and invited them to come to Borges. And so it really developed along those lines.
Bronson enters the picture.
Yeah, that was, I think, 1905, about that. There were some doctors that weren't happy with Borges, and so they started a private hospital, which later became Bronson Hospital, named after Titus Bronson, the founder of Kalamazoo. And there's no way around it. There's rivalry between the two hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
But they all both have their specialties. And so it really is good for the Kalamazoo community to have so much medical care available.
Absolutely. And what kind of challenges is Borges looking at today, tomorrow? Do they have plans for the next 100 years?
Well, I'm sure they do. And, of course, the biggest thing now is keeping the cost of treatment down. That's a national goal.
Yeah,
because things are expensive, and that has to be combated. And then with President Obama's medical solutions, we're hoping that things can be better for people that don't have the insurance that they formerly didn't have, now have.
Well, thank you, Larry.
That's Zinta Astarz speaking with author and historian Larry Massey about his latest book, Healthcare Anew, The First 125 Years of Borges Health. The book was commissioned by the hospital to mark its 125th anniversary this year. A segment of this interview originally aired on Between the Lines in May. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.